Where are the greatest blocks to utility across the buyer experience cycle for your customers and non-customers? Does your offering effectively eliminate these blocks? If it does not, chances are your offering is innovation for innovation's sake, or a revision of existing offerings. When a company's offering passes this test, it is ready to move to the next step. From exceptional utility to strategic pricing. To secure a strong revenue stream for your offering, you must set the right strategic price. This step ensures that buyers not only will want to buy your offering, but also will have a compelling ability to pay for it. Many companies take a reverse course, first testing the waters of a new product or service by targeting novelty-seeking, price-insensitive customers at the launch of a new business idea. Only over time do they drop prices to attract mainstream buyers. It is increasingly important, however, to know from the start what price will quickly capture the mass of target buyers. There are two reasons for this change. First, companies are discovering that volume generates higher returns than it used to. As the nature of goods becomes more knowledge-intensive, companies bear much more of their costs in product development than in manufacturing. This is easy to understand in the software industry. Producing the first copy of the Windows XP operating system, for example, cost Microsoft billions of dollars, whereas subsequent copies involved no more than the nearly trivial cost of a CD. This makes volume key. A second reason is that to a buyer, the value of a product or service may be closely tied to the total number of people using it. An example is the online auction service managed by eBay. People will not buy a product or service when it is used by few others. As a result of this phenomenon, called network externalities, many products and services are an all-or-nothing proposition. Either you sell millions at once, or you sell nothing at all. In the meantime, the rise of knowledge-intensive products also creates the potential for free riding. This relates to the non-rival and partially excludable nature of knowledge. The use of a rival good by one firm precludes its use by another. So, for example, Nobel Prize-winning scientists who are fully employed by IBM cannot simultaneously be employed by another company, nor can scrap steel consumed by Nucor be simultaneously consumed for production by other mini-mill steelmakers. In contrast, the use of a non-rival good by one firm does not limit its use by another. Ideas fall into this category. So, for example, when Virgin Atlantic Airways launched its upper-class brand, a new concept in business-class travel that essentially combined the huge seats and legroom of traditional first-class with the price of business-class tickets, other airlines were free to apply this idea to their own business-class service without limiting Virgin's ability to use it. This makes competitive imitation not only possible but less costly. The cost and risk of developing an innovative idea are borne by the initiator, not the follower. This challenge is exacerbated when the notion of excludability is considered. Excludability is a function both of the nature of the good and of the legal system. A good is excludable if the company can prevent others from using it because of, for example, limited access or patent protection. Intel, for example, can exclude other microprocessor chipmakers from using its manufacturing facilities through property ownership laws. The women's fitness club Curves, however, cannot exclude someone from walking into any of its centers, studying its layout, atmosphere, and exercise routine, and mimicking its women's fitness concept. Women need only 30 minutes, 3 days a week, to get in shape while having fun with other women, with none of the usual embarrassment faced at gyms. The highest value-added element of the Curves formula is not excludable. Once ideas are out there, knowledge naturally spills over to other firms. This lack of excludability reinforces the risk of free riding. Like the creative and explosive concepts of Curves, Starbucks, or Southwest Airlines, many of the most powerful blue ocean ideas have tremendous value, but in themselves consist of no new technological discoveries. As a result, they are neither patentable nor excludable, and hence are vulnerable to imitation. All this means that the strategic price you set for your offering must not only attract buyers in large numbers, but also help you to retain them. Given the high potential for free riding, an offering's reputation must be earned on day one, because brand building increasingly relies heavily on word-of-mouth recommendations spreading rapidly through our networked society. Companies must therefore start with an offer that buyers can't refuse, and must keep it that way to discourage any free-riding imitations. This is what makes strategic pricing key. Strategic pricing addresses this question. Is your offering priced to attract the mass of target buyers from the start, so that they have a compelling ability to pay for it? When exceptional utility is combined with strategic pricing, imitation is discouraged. We have developed a tool called the Price Corridor of the Mass to help managers find the right price for an irresistible offer, which, by the way, isn't necessarily the lower price. The tool involves two distinct but interrelated steps. Step 1. Identify the price corridor of the mass. In setting a price, all companies look first at the products and services that most closely resemble their idea in terms of form. Typically, they look at other products and services within their industries. That's still a necessary exercise, of course, but it is not sufficient to attract new customers. So the main challenge in determining a strategic price is to understand the price sensitivities of those people who will be comparing the new product or service with a host of very different-looking products and services offered outside the group of traditional competitors. A good way to look outside the industry boundaries is to list products and services that fall into two categories: those that take different forms but perform the same function, and those that take different forms and functions but share the same overarching objective. Different form, same function. Many companies that create blue oceans attract customers from other industries who use a product or service that performs the same function or bears the same core utility as the new one, but takes a very different physical form. In the case of Ford's Model T, Ford looked to the horse-drawn carriage. The horse-drawn carriage had the same core utility as the car, transportation for individuals and families, but it had a very different form, a live animal versus a machine. Ford effectively converted the majority of non-customers of the auto industry, namely customers of horse-drawn carriages, into customers of its own blue ocean by pricing its Model T against horse-drawn carriages and not the cars of other automakers. In the case of the school lunch catering industry, raising this question led to an interesting insight. Suddenly, those parents who make their children's lunches came into the equation. For many children, parents had the same function, making their child's lunch. But they had a very different form: mom or dad versus a lunch line in the cafeteria. Different form and function, same objective. Some companies lure customers from even further away. Cirque du Soleil, for example, has diverted customers from a wide range of evening activities. Its growth came in part through drawing people away from other activities that differed in both form and function. For example, bars and restaurants have few physical features in common with the circus. They also serve a distinct function by providing conversational and gastronomical pleasure, a very different experience from the visual entertainment that a circus offers. Yet despite these differences in form and function, people have the same objective in undertaking these three activities: to enjoy a night out. Listing the groups of alternative products and services allows managers to see the full range of buyers they can poach from other industries, as well as from non-industries, such as parents, for the school lunch catering industry, or the noble pencil in managing household finances, for the personal finance software industry. Having done this, managers should then graphically plot the price and volume of these alternatives. This approach provides a straightforward way to identify where the mass of target buyers is and what prices these buyers are prepared to pay for the products and services they currently use. The price bandwidth that captures the largest groups of target buyers is the price corridor of the mass. In some cases, the range is very wide. For Southwest Airlines, for example, the price corridor of the mass covered the group of people paying, on average, $400 to buy an economy class short-haul ticket to about $60 for the cost of going the same distance by car. The key here is not to pursue pricing against the competition within an industry, but rather to pursue pricing against substitutes and alternatives across industries and non-industries. Had Ford, for example, priced its Model T against other autos, which were more than 3 times the price of horse-drawn carriages, the market for the Model T would not have exploded. Step 2. Specify a level within the price corridor. The second part of the tool helps managers determine how high a price they can afford to set within the corridor without inviting competition from imitation products or services. That assessment depends on 2 principal factors. First is the degree to which the product or service is protected legally through patents or copyrights. Second is the degree to which the company owns some exclusive asset or core capability, such as an expensive production plant that can block imitation. Dyson, a British electrical white goods company, for example, has been able to charge a high unit price for its bagless vacuum cleaner since the product's launch in 1995, thanks to both strong patents and hard-to-imitate service capabilities. Many other companies have used upper-boundary strategic pricing to attract the mass of target buyers. Examples include DuPont with its Lycra brand in specialty chemicals, Philips's Alto in the professional lighting industry, SAP in the business application software industry, and Bloomberg in the financial software industry. On the other hand, companies with uncertain patent and asset protection should consider pricing somewhere in the middle of the corridor. As for companies that have no such protection, they must set a relatively low price. In the case of Southwest Airlines, because its service wasn't patentable and required no exclusive assets, its ticket prices fell into the lower boundary of the corridor, namely against the price of car travel. Companies would be wise to pursue mid to lower boundary strategic pricing from the start if any of the following apply. Their Blue Ocean offering has high fixed costs and marginal variable costs. Their attractiveness depends heavily on network externalities. Their cost structure benefits from steep economies of scale and scope. In these cases, volume brings with it significant cost advantages, something that makes pricing for volume even more key. The price corridor of the mass not only signals the strategic pricing zone central to pulling in an ocean of new demand, but also signals how you might need to adjust your initial price estimates to achieve this. When your offering passes the test of strategic pricing, you're ready to move to the next step. From strategic pricing to target costing. Target costing, the next step in the strategic sequence, addresses the profit side of the business model. To maximize the profit potential of a Blue Ocean idea, a company should start with the strategic price and then deduct its desired profit margin from the price to arrive at the target cost. Here, price minus costing and not cost plus pricing is essential if you are to arrive at a cost structure that is both profitable and hard for potential followers to match. When target costing is driven by strategic pricing, however, it is usually aggressive. Part of the challenge of meeting the target cost is addressed in building a strategic profile that has not only divergence but also focus, which makes a company strip out costs. Think of the cost reductions Cirque du Soleil enjoyed by eliminating animals and stars, or that Ford enjoyed by making the Model T in one color and one model, having few options. Sometimes these reductions are sufficient to hit the cost target, but often they are not. Consider the cost innovations that Ford had to introduce to meet its aggressive target cost for the Model T. Ford had to scrap the standard manufacturing system, in which cars were handmade by skilled craftsmen from start to finish. Instead, Ford introduced the assembly line, which replaced skilled craftsmen with ordinary unskilled laborers who worked one small task faster and more efficiently, cutting the time to make a Model T from 21 days to 4 days and cutting labor hours by 60%. Had Ford not introduced these cost innovations, it could not have met its strategic price profitably. Instead of drilling down and finding ways to creatively meet the target cost as Ford did, If companies give in to the tempting route of either bumping up the strategic price or cutting back on utility, they are not on the path to lucrative blue waters. To hit the cost target, companies have three principal levers. The first involves streamlining operations and introducing cost innovations from manufacturing to distribution. Can the products or services' raw materials be replaced by unconventional, less expensive ones? Such as switching from metal to plastic or shifting a call center from the UK to Bangalore. Can high-cost, low-value-added activities in your value chain be significantly eliminated, reduced, or outsourced? Can the physical location of your product or service be shifted from prime real estate locations to lower-cost locations, as the Home Depot, IKEA, and Walmart have done in retail, or Southwest Airlines has done by shifting from major to secondary airports? Can you truncate the number of parts or steps used in production by shifting the way things are made, as Ford did by introducing the assembly line? Can you digitize activities to reduce costs? By probing questions such as these, the Swiss watch company Swatch, for example, was able to arrive at a cost structure some 30% lower than any other watch company in the world. At the start, Nicholas Hayek, chairman of Swatch, set up a project team to determine the strategic price for the Swatch. At the time, cheap, about $75, high-precision quartz watches from Japan and Hong Kong were capturing the mass market. Swatch set the price at $40, a price at which people could buy multiple Swatches as fashion accessories. The low price left no profit margin for Japanese or Hong Kong-based companies to copy Swatch and undercut its price. Directed to sell the Swatch for that price and not a penny more, the Swatch project team worked backwards to arrive at the target cost, a process that involved determining the margin Swatch needed to support marketing and services and earn a profit. Given the high cost of Swiss labor, Swatch was able to achieve this goal only by making radical changes in the product and production methods. Instead of using the more traditional metal or leather, for example, Swatch used plastic. Swatch's engineers also drastically simplified the design of the watch's inner workings, reducing the number of parts from 150 to 51. Finally, the engineers developed new and cheaper assembly techniques. For example, the watch cases were sealed by ultrasonic welding instead of screws. Taken together, the design and manufacturing changes enabled Swatch to reduce direct labor costs from 30% to less than 10% of total costs. These cost innovations produced a cost structure that is hard to beat and let Swatch profitably dominate the mass market for watches, a market previously dominated by Asian manufacturers with a cheaper labor pool. Beyond streamlining operations and introducing cost innovations, a second lever companies can pull to meet their target cost is partnering. In bringing a new product or service to market, many companies mistakenly try to carry out all the production and distribution activities themselves. Sometimes that's because they see the product or service as a platform for developing new capabilities. Other times it is simply a matter of not considering other outside options. Partnering, however, provides a way for companies to secure needed capabilities fast and effectively while dropping their cost structure. It allows a company to leverage other companies' expertise and economies of scale. Partnering includes closing gaps in capabilities through making small acquisitions when doing so is faster and cheaper, providing access to needed expertise that has already been mastered. A large part of IKEA's ability to meet its target cost, for example, comes down to partnering. IKEA seeks out the lowest prices for materials and production via partnering with some 1,500 manufacturing companies in more than 50 countries to ensure at the lowest cost and fastest production of products in its IKEA lineup of some 20,000 items. Or consider German-based world-leading business application software maker SAP. By partnering with Oracle, SAP saved hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in development costs, and got a world-class central database, namely Oracle's, which sits at the heart of SAP's core products R2 and R3. SAP went a step further and also partnered with leading consulting firms, such as Capgemini and Accenture, to gain a global sales force overnight at no extra cost. Whereas Oracle had the fixed costs of a much smaller sales force on its balance sheet, SAP was able to leverage Capgemini's and Accenture's strong global networks to reach SAP's target customers with no cost implication to the company. Sometimes, however, no amount of streamlining and cost innovation or partnering will make it possible for a company to deliver its target cost. This brings us to the third lever companies can use to make their desired profit margin without compromising their strategic price: changing the pricing model of the industry. By changing the pricing model used and not the level of the strategic price, companies can often overcome this problem. When film videotapes first came out, for example, they were priced at around $80. Few people were willing to pay that amount because no one expected to watch the video more than two or three times. The strategic price of a video had to be set in relation to going to the movies and not owning a tape for life. So at $80 a tape, demand was not taking off. How could a company make money by selling the videos at only a few dollars if it followed the path of using strategic pricing? The answer was that it couldn't. Blockbuster, however, got around this problem by changing the pricing model from selling to renting. This allowed it to strategically price videotapes at only a few dollars per rental. The result was that the home video market exploded, and Blockbuster made more money by repeatedly renting the same $80 videos than it could have by selling them outright. Similarly, IBM exploded the tabulating market by shifting the pricing model from selling to leasing to hit its strategic price while covering its cost structure. In addition to Blockbuster's rental model or IBM's leasing model, companies have used several innovations in pricing models to profitably deliver on the strategic price. One model is the timeshare. The New Jersey company NetJets follows this model to make jets accessible to a wide range of corporate customers who buy the right to use a jet for a certain amount of time rather than buy the jet itself. Another model is the slice share. Mutual fund managers, for example, bring high-quality portfolio services, traditionally provided by private banks to the rich, to the small investor by selling a sliver of the portfolio rather than its whole. Some companies are abandoning the concept of price altogether. Instead, they give products to customers in return for an equity interest in the customer's business. Hewlett-Packard, for example, has traded high-powered servers to Silicon Valley startups for a share of their revenues. The customers get immediate access to a key capability, and HP stands to earn a lot more than the price of the machine. The aim is not to compromise on the strategic price, but to hit the target through a new price model. We call this pricing innovation. Remember, however, that what is a pricing innovation for one industry, such as video rentals, is often a standard pricing model in another industry. Value innovation typically maximizes profit by using the foregoing three levers. A company begins with its strategic price, from which it deducts its target profit margin to arrive at its target cost. To hit the cost target that supports that profit, companies have two key levers. One is streamlining and cost innovations, and the other is partnering. When the target cost cannot be met despite all efforts to build a low-cost business model, the company should turn to the third lever, pricing innovation, to profitably meet the strategic price. Of course, even when the target cost can be met, pricing innovation still can be pursued. When a company's offering successfully addresses the profit side of the business model, the company is ready to advance to the final step in the sequence of Blue Ocean strategy. A business model built in the sequence of exceptional utility, strategic pricing, and target costing produces value innovation. Unlike the practice of conventional technology innovators, value innovation is based on a win-win game among buyers, companies, and society. From utility, price, and cost to adoption. Even an unbeatable business model may not be enough to guarantee the commercial success of a blue ocean idea. Almost by definition, it threatens the status quo, and for that reason, it may provoke fear and resistance among a company's three main stakeholders: its employees, its business partners, and the general public. Before plowing forward and investing in the new idea, the company must first overcome such fears by educating the fearful. Employees. Failure to adequately address the concerns of employees about the impact of a new business idea on their livelihoods can be expensive. When Merrill Lynch's management, for example, announced plans to create an online brokerage service, its stock price fell by 14% as reports emerged of resistance and infighting within the company's large retail brokerage division. Before companies go public with an idea, they should make a concerted effort to communicate to employees that they are aware of the threats posed by the execution of the idea. Companies should work with employees to find ways of diffusing the threats so that everyone in the company wins, despite shifts in people's roles, responsibilities, and rewards. In contrast to Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, Dean Witter & Company engaged employees in an open internal discussion of the company's strategy for meeting the challenge of the Internet. Morgan's efforts paid off handsomely. Because the market realized that its employees understood the need for an e-venture, the company's shares rose 13% when it eventually announced the venture. Business partners. Potentially even more damaging than employee disaffection is the resistance of partners who fear that their revenue streams or market positions are threatened by a new business idea. That was the problem faced by SAP when it was developing its product Accelerated SAP, ASAP, an enterprise software system that was fast to implement and hence low cost. ASAP brought business application software within the reach of mid-sized and small companies for the first time. The problem was that the development of best practice templates for ASAP required the active cooperation of large consulting firms that were deriving substantial income from lengthy implementations of SAP's other products. As a result, they were not necessarily incentivized to find the fastest way to implement the company's software. SAP resolved the dilemma by openly discussing the issues with its partners. Its executives convinced the consulting firms that they stood to gain more business by cooperating. Although ASAP would reduce implementation time for small and mid-sized companies, consultants would gain access to a new client base that would more than compensate for some lost revenues from larger companies. The new system would also offer consultants a way to respond to customers' increasingly vocal concerns that business application software took too long to implement. The general public. Opposition to a new business idea can also spread to the general public, especially if the idea is very new and innovative, threatening established social or political norms. The effects can be devastating. Consider Monsanto, which makes genetically modified foods. Its intentions have been questioned by European consumers, largely because of the efforts of environmental groups such as Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, and the Soil Association. The attacks of these groups have struck many chords in Europe, which has a history of environmental concern and powerful agricultural lobbies. Monsanto's mistake was to let others take charge of the debate. The company should have educated the environmental groups as well as the public on the benefits of genetically modified food and its potential to eliminate world famine and disease. When the products came out, Monsanto should have given consumers a choice between organic and genetically modified foods by labeling which products had genetically modified seeds as their base. If Monsanto had taken these steps, then instead of being vilified, it might have ended up as the Intel Inside of food for the future, the provider of the essential technology. In educating these three groups of stakeholders, your employees, your partners, and the general public, the key challenge is to engage in an open discussion about why the adoption of the new idea is necessary. You need to explain its merits, set clear expectations for its ramifications, and describe how the company will address them. Stakeholders need to know that their voices have been heard and that there will be no surprises. Companies that take the trouble to have such a dialogue with stakeholders will find that it amply repays the time and effort involved. For a fuller discussion of how companies can engage stakeholders, see Chapter 8. The Blue Ocean Idea Index. Although companies should build their Blue Ocean strategy in the sequence of utility, price, cost, and adoption, these criteria form an integral whole to ensure commercial success. The Blue Ocean Idea, or BOI, Index provides a simple but robust test of this system view. Had Philips's CDI and Motorola's Iridium scored their ideas on the BOI index, they would have seen how far they were from opening up lucrative blue oceans. With respect to Philips CDI, it did not create exceptional buyer utility with its offering of complex technological functions and limited software titles. It was priced out of reach of the mass of buyers, and its manufacturing process was complicated and costly. With its complicated design, it took more than 30 minutes to explain and sell to customers, something that gave no incentive for sales clerks to sell CDI in fast-moving retail. Philips CDI therefore failed all four criteria on the BOI index, despite the billions poured into it. By assessing the business idea of the CDI against the BOI index during development, Philips could have foreseen the shortcomings embedded in the idea and addressed them up front by simplifying the product and locking in partners to develop winning software titles, setting a strategic price accessible to the masses, instituting price minus costing instead of cost plus pricing, and working with retail to find a simple, easy way for the sales force to sell and explain the product in a few minutes. Similarly, Motorola's Iridium was unreasonably expensive because of high production costs. It provided no attractive utility for the mass of buyers, not being usable in buildings or cars, and being the size of a brick. When it came to adoption, Motorola overcame many regulations and secured transmission rights from numerous countries. Employees, partners, and the society were also reasonably motivated to accept the idea, but the company had a weak sales team and marketing channels in the global markets. Because Motorola was not able to follow up sales leads effectively, Iridium phone sets were sometimes unavailable when requested. Weak utility, price, and cost positions, plus average adoption ability, indicated that the Iridium idea would be a flop. In contrast to these failures, consider NTT Docomo's iMode launch in Japan. In 1999, when most telecom operators were focusing on technology races and price competition over voice-based wireless devices, NTT Docomo, the largest Japanese telecom operator, launched iMode to offer the Internet on cell phones. Regular mobile telephony in Japan had reached a high level of sophistication in terms of mobility, quality of voice, ease of use, and hardware design. But it offered few data-based services, such as email, access to information, news and games, and transaction capabilities, which were the killer applications of the PC Internet world. The iMode service brought together the key advantages of these two alternative industries, the cell phone industry and the PC Internet industry, and created unique and superior buyer utility. The iMode service offered exceptional buyer utility at a price accessible to the mass of buyers. The monthly iMode subscription fee, the voice and data transmission fee, and the price of content were in the non-reflection strategic price zone, encouraging impulse buying and reaching the masses as quickly as possible. For example, the monthly subscription fee for a content site is between 100 and 300 yen, $1 and $3, which is the result of benchmarking against the price of the weekly magazines most Japanese regularly pick up at their train station kiosk. After setting a price that was attractive to the mass of buyers, NTT Docomo strove to obtain the capabilities it needed to deliver the service within its cost target in order to turn a profit. In achieving this end, the company was never bounded by its own assets and capabilities. While it focused on its traditional role as an operator to develop and maintain a high-speed, high-capacity network in the iMode project, it sought to deliver other key elements of its offering by actively partnering with handset manufacturers and information providers. By creating a win-win partnership network, the company aimed to meet and sustain the target cost set by its strategic price. Although there were many partners and dimensions involved in its partnership network, a few aspects are particularly relevant here. First, NTT Docomo regularly and persistently shared know-how and technology with its handset manufacturing partners to help them stay ahead of their competitors. Second, the company played the role of the portal and gateway to the wireless network, expanding and updating the list of iMode menu sites while attracting content providers to join the iMode list and create the content that would boost user traffic. By handling the billing for the content providers with a small commission fee, for example, The company offered content providers major cost savings associated with billing system development. At the same time, Docomo also obtained a growing revenue stream for itself. More importantly, instead of using the wireless markup language, WML, under the WAP standard for site creation, iMode used CHTML, an existing and already widely used language in Japan. This made iMode more attractive to content providers because under CHTML, software engineers needed no retraining to convert their existing websites, designed for the internet environment, into sites for iMode use, and thus they incurred no additional costs. NTT Docomo also entered into collaborative arrangements with key foreign partners, such as Sun Microsystems, Microsoft, and Symbian, to reduce the total development costs and shorten the time for an effective launch. Another key aspect of the iMode strategy was the way the project was carried out. A team specially dedicated to the project was set up and given a clear mandate and autonomy. The head of the iMode team selected most of the team members and engaged them in an open discussion on how to create the new market of mobile data communications, making them committed to the project. All of this created a favorable corporate environment for the adoption of iMode. Moreover, the win-win game the company created for its partners, as well as the readiness of the Japanese general public to use database services, also contributed to the successful adoption of iMode. The iMode service passed all four criteria on the BOI index. Indeed, iMode turned out to be an explosive success. 6 months after its launch, subscribers had reached the 1 million mark. Within 2 years, the number of subscribers had reached 21.7 million, and revenues from packet transmission alone had increased 130 times. By the end of 2003, the number of subscribers had reached 40.1 million, and revenues from the transmission of data, pictures, and text increased from 295 million yen, $2.6 million, to 886.3 billion yen, $8 billion. Docomo is the only company that has been able to make money out of the mobile internet. Docomo now exceeds its parent company, NTT, in terms of market capitalization as well as potential for profitable growth. Although iMode has been a huge success in Japan, its success outside Japan hinges on whether it can overcome regional adoption barriers of a regulatory, cultural, and emotional nature, as well as those stemming from partnership dynamics and infrastructure economics. Having passed the Blue Ocean Idea Index, companies are ready to shift gears from the formulation side of Blue Ocean strategy to its execution. The question is, how do you bring an organization with you to execute this strategy, even though it often represents a significant departure from the past? This brings us to the second part of this book, and the fifth principle of Blue Ocean Strategy, overcoming key organizational hurdles, the subject of our next chapter. Part 3. Executing Blue Ocean Strategy. Chapter 7. Overcoming Key Organizational Hurdles. Once a company has developed a Blue Ocean Strategy with a profitable business model, it must execute it. The challenge of execution exists, of course, for any strategy. Companies, like individuals, often have a tough time translating thought into action, whether in red or blue oceans. But compared with red ocean strategy, blue ocean strategy represents a significant departure from the status quo. It hinges on a shift from convergence to divergence in value curves at lower costs. That raises the execution bar. Managers have assured us that the challenge is steep. They face four hurdles. One is cognitive, waking employees up to the need for a strategic shift. Red oceans may not be the paths to future profitable growth, but they feel comfortable to people and may have even served an organization well until now, so why rock the boat? The second hurdle is limited resources. The greater the shift in strategy, the greater it is assumed are the resources needed to execute it. But resources were being cut and not raised in many of the organizations we studied. Third is motivation. How do you motivate key players to move fast and tenaciously to carry out a break from the status quo? That will take years, and managers don't have that kind of time. The final hurdle is politics. As one manager put it, in our organization you get shot down before you stand up. Although all companies face different degrees of these hurdles, and many may face only some subset of the four, knowing how to triumph over them is key to attenuating organizational risk. This brings us to the fifth principle of the Blue Ocean Strategy. Overcome key organizational hurdles to make Blue Ocean Strategy happen in action. To achieve this effectively, however, companies must abandon perceived wisdom on affecting change. Conventional wisdom asserts that the greater the change, the greater the resources and time you will need to bring about results. Instead, you need to flip conventional wisdom on its head using what we call tipping point leadership. Tipping point leadership allows you to overcome these four hurdles fast and at low cost while winning employees' backing in executing a break from the status quo. Tipping point leadership in action. Consider the New York City Police Department, NYPD, which executed a Blue Ocean strategy in the 1990s in the public sector. When Bill Bratton was appointed police commissioner of New York City in February 1994, the odds were stacked against him to an extent few executives ever face. In the early 1990s, New York City was veering toward anarchy. Murders were at an all-time high. Muggings, mafia hits, vigilantes, and armed robberies filled the daily headlines. New Yorkers were under siege. But Bratton's budget was frozen. Indeed, after 3 decades of mounting crime in New York City, many social scientists had concluded that it was impervious to police intervention. The citizens of New York City were crying out. A front-page headline in the New York Post had screamed, "Dave, do something," a direct call to then-Mayor David Dinkins to get crime down fast. With miserable pay, dangerous working conditions, long hours, and little hope of advancement in a 10-year promotion system, morale among the NYPD's 36,000 officers was at rock bottom. Not to mention the debilitating effects of budget cuts, dilapidated equipment, and corruption. In business terms, the NYPD was a cash-strapped organization with 36,000 employees wedded to the status quo, unmotivated and underpaid. A disgruntled customer base, New York citizens, and rapidly declining performance as measured by the increase in crime, fear, and disorder. Entrenched turf wars and politics topped off the cake. In short, leading the NYPD to execute a shift in strategy was a managerial nightmare far beyond the imaginations of most executives. The competition, the criminals, was strong and rising. Yet in less than 2 years and without an increase in his budget, Bratton turned New York City into the safest large city in the United States. He broke out of the Red Ocean with a Blue Ocean policing strategy that revolutionized U.S. policing as it was then known. Between 1994 and 1996, the organization won as profits jumped. Felony crime fell 39%, murders 50%, and theft 35%. Customers won. Gallup polls reported that public confidence in the NYPD leaped from 37% to 73%. And employees won. Internal surveys showed job satisfaction in the NYPD reaching an all-time high. As one patrolman put it, "We would have marched to hell and back for that guy." Perhaps most impressively, the changes have outlasted its leader, implying a fundamental shift in the organizational culture and strategy of the NYPD. Even after Bratton's departure in 1996, crime rates have continued to fall. Few corporate leaders face organizational hurdles as steep as Bratton did in executing a break from the status quo. And still fewer are able to orchestrate the type of performance leap that Bratton achieved under any organizational conditions, let alone those as stringent as he encountered. Even Jack Welch needed some 10 years and tens of millions of dollars of restructuring and training to turn GE into a powerhouse. Moreover, defying conventional wisdom, Bratton achieved these breakthrough results in record time with scarce resources while lifting employee morale, creating a win-win for all involved. Nor was this Bratton's first strategic reversal. It was his fifth, with each of the others also achieved, despite his facing all four hurdles that managers consistently claim limit their ability to execute Blue Ocean strategy. the cognitive hurdle that blinds employees from seeing that radical change is necessary, the resource hurdle that is endemic in firms, the motivational hurdle that discourages and demoralizes staff, and the political hurdle of internal and external resistance to change. The pivotal lever, disproportionate influence factors. Tipping point leadership traces its roots to the field of epidemiology and the theory of tipping points. It hinges on the insight that in any organization, fundamental changes can happen quickly when the beliefs and energies of a critical mass of people create an epidemic movement toward an idea. Key to unlocking an epidemic movement is concentration, not diffusion. Tipping point leadership builds on the rarely exploited corporate reality that in every organization, there are people, acts, and activities that exercise a disproportionate influence on performance. Hence, contrary to conventional wisdom, mounting a massive challenge is not about putting forth an equally massive response where performance gains are achieved by proportional investments in time and resources. Rather, it is about conserving resources and cutting time by focusing on identifying and then leveraging the factors of disproportionate influence in an organization. The key questions answered by tipping point leaders are as follows. What factors or acts exercise a disproportionately positive influence on breaking the status quo? On getting the maximum bang out of each buck of resources? On motivating key players to aggressively move forward with change? And on knocking down political roadblocks that often trip up even the best strategies? By single-mindedly focusing on points of disproportionate influence, tipping point leaders can topple the four hurdles that limit execution of Blue Ocean strategy. They can do this fast and at low cost. Let us consider how you can leverage disproportionate influence factors to tip all four hurdles to move from thought to action in the execution of Blue Ocean strategy. Break through the cognitive hurdle. In many turnarounds and corporate transformations, the hardest battle is simply to make people aware of the need for a strategic shift and to agree on its causes. Most CEOs will try to make the case for change simply by pointing to the numbers and insisting that the company set and achieve better results. There are only two performance alternatives, to make the performance targets or to beat them. But as we all know, figures can be manipulated. Insisting on stretch goals encourages abuse in the budgetary process. This in turn creates hostility and suspicion between the various parts of an organization. Even when the numbers are not manipulated, they can mislead. Salespeople on commission, for example, are seldom sensitive to the costs of the sales they produce. What's more, messages communicated through numbers seldom stick with people. The case for change feels abstract and removed from the sphere of the line managers, who are the very people the CEO needs to win over. Those whose units are doing well feel that the criticism is not directed at them. The problem is top management's. Meanwhile, managers of poorly performing units feel that they are being put on notice, and people who are worried about personal job security are more likely to scan the job market than to try to solve the company's problems. Tipping point leadership does not rely on numbers to break through the organization's cognitive hurdle. To tip the cognitive hurdle fast, tipping point leaders such as Bratton zoom in on the act of disproportionate influence, making people see and experience harsh reality firsthand. Research in neuroscience and cognitive science shows that people remember and respond most effectively to what they see and experience. Seeing is believing. In the realm of experience, positive stimuli reinforce behavior, whereas negative stimuli change attitudes and behavior. Simply put, if a child puts a finger in icing and tastes it, the better it tastes, the more the child will taste it repetitively. No parental advice is needed to encourage that behavior. Conversely, after a child puts a finger on a burning stove, he or she will never do it again. After a negative experience, children will change their behavior of their own accord. Again, no parental pestering is required. On the other hand, experiences that don't involve touching, seeing, or feeling actual results, such as being presented with an abstract sheet of numbers, are shown to be non-impactful and easily forgotten. Tipping point leadership builds on this insight to inspire a fast change in mindset that is internally driven of people's own accord. Instead of relying on numbers to tip the cognitive hurdle, they make people experience the need for change in two ways. Ride the electric sewer. To break the status quo, employees must come face-to-face with the worst operational problems. Don't let top brass, middle brass, or any brass hypothesize about reality. Numbers are disputable and uninspiring, but coming face-to-face with poor performance is shocking and inescapable, but actionable. This direct experience exercises a disproportionate influence on tipping people's cognitive hurdle fast. Consider this example. In the 1990s, the New York subway system reeked of fear, so much so that it earned the epithet electric sewer. Revenues were tumbling fast as citizens boycotted the system. But members of the New York City Transit Police Department were in denial. Why? Only 3% of the city's major crimes happened in the subway. So no matter how much the public cried out, their cries fell on deaf ears. There was no perceived need to rethink police strategies. Then Bratton was appointed chief, and in a matter of weeks he orchestrated a complete break from the status quo in the mindset of the city's police. How? Not by force, nor by arguing for numbers, but by making top brass and middle brass, starting with himself, ride the electric sewer day and night. Until Bratton came along, this had not been done. Although the statistics may have told the police that the subway was safe, what they now saw was what every New Yorker faced every day, a subway system on the verge of anarchy. Gangs of youths patrolled the cars, people jumped turnstiles, and the riders faced graffiti, aggressive begging, and winos sprawled over benches. The police could no longer evade the ugly truth. No one could argue that current police strategies didn't require a substantial departure from the status quo. And fast. Showing the worst reality to your superiors can also shift their mindset fast. A similar approach works to help sensitize superiors to a leader's needs fast. Yet few leaders exploit the power of this rapid wake-up call. Rather, they do the opposite. They try to garner support based on a numbers case that lacks urgency and emotional impetus. Or they try to put forth the most exemplary case of their operational excellence to garner support. Although these alternatives may work, neither leads to tipping superiors' cognitive hurdle as fast and stunningly as showing the worst. When Bratton, for example, was running the police division of the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority, MBTA, the MBTA board decided to purchase small squad cars that would be cheaper to buy and to run. That went against Bratton's new policing strategy. Instead of fighting the decision, however, or arguing for a larger budget, something that would have taken months to reevaluate and probably would have been rejected in the end, Bratton invited the MBTA's general manager for a tour of his unit to see the district. To let the general manager see the horror he was trying to rectify, Bratton picked him up in a small car just like the ones that were being ordered. He jammed the seats up front to let the manager feel how little legroom a 6-foot cop would get, and then Bratton drove over every pothole he could. Bratton also put on his belt, cuffs, and gun for the trip so that the manager would see how little space there was for the tools of the police officer's trade. After 2 hours, the manager wanted out. He told Bratton he didn't know how Bratton could stand being in such a cramped car for so long on his own, never mind having a criminal in the back seat. Bratton got the larger cars his new strategy demanded. Meet with disgruntled customers. To tip the cognitive hurdle, not only must you get your managers out of the office to see operational horror, but also you must get them to listen to their most disgruntled customers firsthand. Don't rely on market surveys. To what extent does your top team actively observe the market firsthand and meet with your most disgruntled customers to hear their concerns? Do you ever wonder why sales don't match your confidence in your product? Simply put, there is no substitute for meeting and listening to dissatisfied customers directly. In the late 1970s, Boston's Police District 4, which housed the Symphony Hall, Christian Science Mother Church, and other cultural institutions, was experiencing a serious surge in crime. The public was increasingly intimidated. Residents were selling their homes and leaving, thereby pushing the community into a downward spiral. But even though the citizens were leaving the area in droves, the police force under Bratton's direction felt they were doing a fine job. The performance indicators they historically used to benchmark themselves against other police departments were tip-top. 911 response times were down and felony crime arrests were up. To solve the paradox, Bratton arranged a series of town hall meetings between his officers and the neighborhood residents. It didn't take long to find the gap in perceptions. Although the police officers took great pride in short response times and their record in solving major crimes, these efforts went unnoticed and unappreciated by citizens. Few felt endangered by large-scale crimes. What they felt victimized by and harassed by were the constant minor irritants, winos, panhandlers, prostitutes, and graffiti.